The expressed views of the guests on this podcast are theirs alone and not necessarily endorsed by the host, TWBC, or any associated sponsor. Conversations that are robust yet balanced, on point and to the point. You are listening to The Talk of Tournament Water Ski. This is the TWBC Podcast. And now, here's your host, Tony Lightfoot.
Well, here we are in a quiet little corner of Italy, in the midst of all of the excitement and chaos that comes with the World Water Ski Championship in 2025. I'm Tony Lightfoot, and this is another episode of the TWBC Podcast, and thanking you for your support once again. Well, in these championships, there have been a number of personalities that are shone through so far as on the water is concerned, but almost as much of a personality as some of these skiers are one or two of the officials, and of course refer to the drivers. And one of the drivers in this tournament that has made himself a name in the sport of tournament water skiing for, I don't know, it's been close to about 40 years now. And with that, I introduce you to the one, the only, the Scott, the Rocket Man Ellis. How are you doing, sir?
Hey, Tony, I'm doing good.
Good, good. So, you're involved as one of the drivers at the World Championships. How did you get that gig?
I've been behind the boat for a long time, but now I'm in the boat driving. I get to drive a bunch of local tournaments. I guess my skills, I guess you can say, kind of rose up through the ranks, and I've been lucky enough to drive some big tournaments, and now I'm in the biggest tournament of the world, so I'm pretty excited.
So just the gradual, simple, easy steps.
Yeah, just, you know, baby steps for about 10 years.
indeed. Okay, let's go back all the way back in the midst of time. How'd you get involved in all of this? So starting out tournament skiing.
Geez, I'll tell you, it's kind of weird, but the word taco plays a major role in the beginning of my water skiing.
So, taco.
So in the late 70s, my parents and all their relatives, all the Ellises, would go down to a lake who had a park. Across the street from the park was Taco Bell. On Sundays, they had Taco Bell Sunday, 49-cent tacos. So we'd all meet down there. We would all ski. Enjoy the 49-cent tacos, and that's how we got kind of introduced into the family part of it. And then we were told, hey, you know, down the road is the Lakeland Water Ski Show. They put on water ski shows every Sunday.
Wow.
So my parents went down there. We all watched the show. The show director at the end of the shows would say, hey, if anybody's interested in wanting to join the show, come on down.
Wow.
So my parents... We joined the ski club, we started doing ski shows, and then it just kind of morphed into a water ski career.
So I kind of see that little bit now, because, I mean, I remember, like, water ski magazines back in the day of you still very much a junior pulling off a one ski backflip.
Yeah.
I think there was a whole, like, one or two page spread in that magazine. I mean, that's pretty wild, I have to say.
I credit a lot of my talent through show skiing. We skied in all kinds of conditions, rough water, calm water, always in front of a crowd. And it just kind of, I mean, it helped in the tournament water skiing, you know.
Just being able to tough it out through the toughest conditions. I mean,
yeah, no matter what, the show must go on. And that's just kind of the basis of my career.
So, I mean, just try and remember back to one of your previous tournaments all the way back. I mean, what has been some of the roughest stuff that you've skied in tournament-wise back in the day? Because, I mean, you started out in Central Florida, Lakeland, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
But there are some big open water sites that are full of gators, you know, exposed to the wind, all that kind of stuff. Moccasins every which way.
Yeah. Lots of reptiles, lots of wind, lots of rain. I started back before private lakes were kind of a big thing. All the tournaments were in big public waterways, and we didn't wait for conditions to slow down. You skied in no matter what. You didn't have to ski great. You didn't have to have a PB, but you just had to win on the day. And that's part of what show skiing kind of taught me, is you learn how to ski in rough conditions. and I think it makes you a tough skier.
Okay, so how did you make that kind of transition from show skiing into tournament skiing? Because I mean, you skied in the roughest conditions. You know how to ski on one, and basically auditioned all of the events, I would imagine, through that show ski world.
Yeah.
So how did you get to the point where you were show skiing to the point where they were selecting you to represent the United States in, like, say, I don't know, like the junior world, in the
88 junior worlds.
88 junior worlds, I think, was in Melbourne, right?
Melbourne, yeah, it was on the Yarra River, one of the hardest places to ski on the planet.
So
yeah.
That show ski experience really
paid off.
Yeah.
So our ski club, the Lakeland Ski Club, put on two water ski tournaments a year. The Lakeland Open, which is still the longest running water ski tournament in the world. Jeff Clark just got an award for that for the Lakeland Water Ski Club. And they also put on the Lakeland 3-Round Trick, where all the pros came to trick. So I went to tournament skiing. I kind of morphed over from show skiing. I did slalom, trick, and jump. I really liked it. Those tournaments gave trophies out to all the kids at every tournament. So
wow.
I would walk home with, you know, a handful of trophies. And then I was hooked. I enjoyed tournament skiing, and I enjoyed the trophies.
Who were some of your contemporaries? Do you remember who was on that USA team at the time?
Oh, the junior U.S. team, yes.
Yeah, junior U.S. team in the 88 junior worlds.
April Coble, Karen Trulove.
Of course, from North Carolina.
Katie Wiswall, and myself.
Wow.
Yeah.
It was a compact team. I mean, because back in those days, the junior worlds, you weren't permitted to submit a team of any more than four competitors.
Yeah, just four people, yeah.
And at that time, they didn't have specialists, did they?
No.
No.
It was a three event. You needed to do three event to get the team.
So how did you fare in those junior worlds?
I did pretty good. In the junior worlds, I won slalom. I ended up being junior world slalom champion. I got second in jump to J.D. Wiswall. I was third in tricks, and I won overall. So that was by far my best tournament of my entire life.
In overall.
So I was pretty happy.
Okay, so... So I mean, you got past 1988. I don't know. Were you selected for another Junior Worlds after that?
I aged out after that. 1989. The next year, I opted out of junior. Well, I didn't opt out, but I aged out of juniors. Some of the junior guys, like J.D. Wiswall and those guys, they went straight to the pros because that's kind of what you did back then.
Mm-hmm.
There was no 5.5. No speed transition. We went from 5 foot 30 miles an hour to 6 foot 35 miles an hour. It was a big jump.
Yeah, because I tried to make that transition of 5.5 to 6 foot myself. I mean, and I hurt my back something rotten. You know, when you come down from that high going out the back. I mean, you've experienced it enough times in your life, haven't you?
Yeah. I don't want to experience it anymore. I've done it so much. But instead of making that big jump, my dad kept me back 1 year, and it's called Men 1 Division, it's an age division, where I didn't jump to the full height. I stayed at 35 miles an hour. I did 5.5 foot ramp. And then in 1990, I made the transition to open men.
Okay.
And then my career just took off.
Most certainly did. I mean, what was it in about the early and mid 90s? You were involved in the Michelob Dry Water Ski Tour. I mean, it was like the tour wars back in those times. You know, as mentioned by the late great Ed Brazil. I mean, we all remember that article and series of articles written by him about the state of tournament water skiing, and you're a right slap bang in the middle of it because you were winning those tournaments that were part of the Mick Dry Tour, weren't you?
Mick Dry Tour, and then there was the Paws Tour, and my dad just like, listen, you're a rookie, stick to one tour. And eventually you can do both tours if you want. But right now, let's stick to the Michelob Dry Tour. And I did really good. I won a bunch of tour stops. I won the overall tour title. And just, I kind of, it got me hooked. It got my confidence. And
what year was that? And it was in
1990.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, just imagine what you were jumping with at that time. I mean, yeah. What branded skis were you jumping?
I was on EP skis.
The aerial skis.
Yeah, the aerials, but they had the cone shape. They didn't get the square tips yet.
Mm-hmm.
Very skinny, very short. Back then, we didn't have our own jump ropes. You had to use a tournament supplied rope.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
You were at the mercy of what Ed was providing for you at that time.
In the mood for that's what you got.
Yeah, remember that time. You know, so do you remember much of anything about those tour stops individually? I mean, obviously there was the Orlando one to kick things off. Where was the Orlando tour stop at that time in 1990?
They had a place called Mission, no, not Mission Bay, that was San Diego. There was a park in Orlando.
Barnett Park,
yeah. And we would have them there. Sometimes it would shift around in Orlando, just kind of depending on, I don't know, whoever was running things in Orlando.
Did you ever dream of skiing on Lake Eola?
I actually, when I went to UCF in 90, that was our training facility.
So wow.
I practiced on Lake Eola.
Right.
And the surface was a wooden surface.
Wow.
Yeah.
Bet those skis stuck pretty hard.
Yeah, it wasn't not a fast ramp like it is today.
And I mean, in the techniques back in the day, I mean, in 1990, I mean, you had the short skis, didn't you? I mean, you were probably one of the last pros.
That has experienced short skis, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean,
all the kids now have no idea those little tiny little things that we jumped on.
Yeah, I mean, I remember jumping on 74-inch jump skis. And, I mean, you try to press on those things.
Yeah, there's no pressing.
you just go straight up and you just try and avoid it.
You would feel like you were pressing forward, but you look at photos, we're standing straight up and down.
Yeah, you weren't pressing forward too much until you... Till we got to about, what was it, 1996, 1997?
Yeah, I think 97. Goodman came out with a pair of 80s for a jumper named Will Dan.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. I saw the advert in the back of one of the water ski magazines with this guy that was yay tall and the skis that were yay high.
So big, and we're like, oh, there's no way. Those skis are way too big. There's no way. But this kid jumped really good on them and looked good. So, of course, Bruce Neville telling Ron, I want a pair of skis. We got to try them. And they went from 80s to 84s to 86s. And now I think the guys are on like 93, 94-inch jumpers.
Even 84s are short now.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So my son's 16. He's on 84s.
Wow.
Yeah. And we used to think those were huge, unskiable back in the day.
I mean, and darn hard to travel with even today.
They are hard to travel with, yes.
So, I mean, let's go back a little bit to the early 90s. I mean, you were jumping on tour, and you were still involved a little bit with overall, but not nearly as much, huh?
Yeah, still doing a little bit overall. Like, I did overall at Masters. I've done three of it at Masters. I was still good, but not like Jerry Llewellyn good. Patrice was still in there. Sammy was still in there. Carl. I enjoyed it, but once I kind of took off in jumping in 90, that was my focus. Before that, it was more slalom trick because I was never really a good jumper as a junior. I was okay, but I never won anything as a junior. But once 6 foot got a hold of me, I guess all the coaching from McCormick's kind of all clicked,
mm-hmm.
and I started going big. Yeah, I just never looked back.
I think I remember seeing you ski a little bit at McCormick's over in Cefna at the early part of the 1990s. I'm sure that you were at that time, as you were transitioning from show skiing into tournament skiing, that you needed to find a place that had some decent conditions on a regular basis without having to, you know, just.
It was close to. We lived in Lakeland. It was close to Lakeland. I was close in age with the McCormick boys, so my dad just kind of put me over there. We skied a bunch, we trained a bunch, and just Jim was an awesome coach. You know, he just didn't teach me how to jump, but he taught me how to win tournaments, which I think is very important, which I've passed on to everyone who comes, you know, through my place through ski school, is you got to learn how to win on the day. And I think that's very important as an athlete.
Yeah, kind of get a little bit more in depth with that, you know, because I mean, I see plenty of skiers out there that ski, that have the skills that they can, they're capable of producing a score, but then when it comes down to it, to the brass tacks of being able to, like, say, okay, I'm in this first round, I need to get to the final, need this score. Yeah. What do you do?
You gotta block aside the end target. Like, yes, you want to win. Everybody wants to win. However, you got to get there. You got to pass through a couple gates, a couple trials to get to your target. So you need to focus on what you're doing. You narrow it down. You make it simple, and you achieve your target. Doesn't need to be a personal best. You just need to go to the next round, and then go to the next round, and then at the finals, you go for the win. If you only need to jump 205 feet, then jump 205 feet. You don't need to jump 250. You know what I mean? So you go for the win, and you strategize and get your mind ready for that win.
Okay, so now that you establish yourself in the 1990s over at Jim McCormick's place over in Cessna, and you've gotten real consistent. I mean, you were back on that singular pro tour because the tours are kind of like merged, or was one just kicking the other one out of business? Yeah. I don't know. But you chuckled there a little bit.
Yeah, they one tried to work, the other one worked, one didn't, and then we all kind of came back together to make one tour. We've kind of all been unified since then.
What was that whole process of kind of like merging those tours? Because I'm sure that there was a bit of animosity between you and those skiers from the other tour, right?
A little bit. I would say for like a year. A little bit, because they're like the ones who went on one tour and it wasn't successful. They're like, it's because you didn't come with us and you should have done it. And I mean, I was 18 years old back then. I didn't know. Like, I was just kind of doing what my dad said. I stuck to one thing. But after that year, I think once we passed 91, we reached 92, 93. We were all unified again. We all wanted to do a good tour. We had a lot of tours in the U.S., and I think it was successful.
Indeed. So did you ever ponder the notion of actually skiing collegiately, though?
I did for a little bit. I did UCF a little bit. I had the collegiate jump record for a little while until John Swanson beat it. So I think I had it for about 2 weeks at 174, and then he went 177. So I skied collegiate for a little bit, just not the full 4 years.
Tell us a little bit about that article that was in the Water Ski Magazine that featured you with like the jeans and Jim Clooney and John Swanson.
It was like the new guys coming on the play. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Kind of give us a little bit of background on that one, because that photo shoot must have been hilarious.
Oh, it was awesome. We were downtown Orlando. The Stone Temple Pilots were playing. We went to that concert. We were like the new generation. So it was Jim Clooney, Jerry Llewellyn, John Swanson, and myself. And mm-hmm. we were like the four new guys competing against guys like Sammy, Carl, Bruce Neville. We were like, it was the, not the old guys, but the guys that had been there and the new guys coming up. And it was just a really cool time. Like, we were chasing Sammy, we were chasing Carl, and we slowly started to beat those guys. And it was, I mean, as a young skier coming up, it was one of the best times of my life. Like, to beat our idols, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, especially the likes of those competitors and Mike Hazelwood and Carl Roberge. Yeah. I mean, they were like the ions right at the very top. But in this sport, I mean, when the highs are highs, they're good. But when the lows and lows, they just flat out suck, you know. And you probably experienced probably one of the lowest lows with the injury that almost took you out of the sport completely, right?
Yeah. I mean, I dislocated my hip, dislocated my knee, got nerve damage, which I still suffer today. I have dropped foot. I can't lift my – what's the most important – right leg and jumping is to keep your tip up. That ski kept falling down. I had multiple doctors, and I was 24 years old, just starting to do my climb and success in water skiing. Doctor is saying, you got to quit. You're never going to ski again. You're going to walk with a limp. That's just negative, 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 negative. And it affected me pretty bad for about a year.
So who was the doctor that said it, that said, be positive, be positive?
Yeah. So it was actually a nerve doctor, a nerve chiropractor out of Tampa. Said, I know what the problem is. Yes, you can ski again. You might not be at the best, but you can still ski. Like, you can still do it. And I came out of my stumper, like, and I was like, okay, let's do it. My dad said, let's go. Let's do it. Let's work on it. And I trained for a year. The first tournament I went back to, I won.
Wow. What tournament was that?
That was Moomba 1997.
Wow.
And I won. And I went straight to number one in the world.
Wow.
Yeah. So I went from never skiing again, being like, I was told handicapped, to being number one in the world. And I never looked back.
Do you still keep that heel stabilizer piece?
I still have an AFO brace in my jump ski. I still trip all the time. I trip walking up steps. I can't wear flip-flops. I still suffer from it. However, I've skied longer with it than I was a kind of a normal jumper, I guess you could say. I use a lot of duct tape.
Yeah, I can imagine that grocery bill.
Yeah,
so go to over at Ace Hardware Store.
Yeah, I use a lot of duct tape. But it's just something, I don't know, when the doctor told me that, something changed. And I became a really good skier after that. If I hadn't had my injury, I would never had that drive to be good. I have no idea. But something clicked when he told me, yeah, you can ski. You might not be as good, but yeah, you can still
ski. Yeah.
Yeah. And I never looked back.
Indeed, indeed. And you certainly didn't look back beyond that victory over in Moomba. So how did you do on that very first full season? Because, I mean, winning once is one thing, but being consistent enough to actually complete the season and actually score up pretty high on some of those remaining tour stops, I mean...
Just the ball kept going. I would do better. Confidence got better. I trained. And I lost that part of my mind, or that part that was told that I can't do it anymore, it was gone. I mean, completely gone. And even now, I still wear the brace. Yeah, I still wear the duct tape, just like I did in 1997. That has not changed. However, I like it. I'm not going to let that slow me down. I teach my kids that. Anybody who comes to the ski school, I teach them that, you know, frame of mind. Like, if you want to do it, you can do it. We work around obstacles, and you make it work.
Okay, so in amongst all of this, you made the move out to Auburndale, right, onto Lake Tennessee, right? Kind of give us an idea of what it was like to establish your own place, your own existence out there, right from the get-go.
So it's just, we were lucky enough to where my parents, we lived on a lake. We had a ramp. There weren't a lot of private lakes around for different ski schools, so I would kind of surround myself around the tour jumpers. I'm like, hey, come ski with me. So we would always have, you know, John Livingston from Australia, Curtis Shears from Australia, myself, mm-hmm. Ryan Fitz. We'd always have a group of guys that we would train together, and we would feed off each other and train together. And that's what kept us, I think, at such an elite level, is because we used each other to get better.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, you just feed off each other. I mean, because it takes a village, really. It does.
It does. You it's hard to do it alone. Yeah.
Okay, so you established yourself in Auburndale, and you surrounded yourself with some of the best talent in the world. I mean, Lake Tennessee is a really, really exposed lake, it would seem. But, I mean, I'm guessing it harks back to your show skiing days that you were prepared to go out there and experience the extremes and conditions so far as rough water and weather are concerned.
Yeah, and I think some of these skiers who grow up on private sites that are perfect I think they missed that quality of big lakes, open lakes, rough water, wind from multiple directions. When you're at a private site and everything's perfect all the time, yes, you get some great scores. However, you go to places like Moomba, U.S. Masters, open lakes, public lakes, you know, they tend to get nervous. They tend to have bad performances or they don't win.
And many just bulk at just jumping with a tailwind full stop.
Yeah, they freak out.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I don't train at a tailwind, but I do ride my skis in a tailwind because I need to remind myself what it feels like, because you will have probably at least one tournament a year where they can't move the ramp.
Mm-hmm.
You need to win or perform in a tailwind.
Like this tournament.
Like this one, because you never know. Yeah, you know, if the weather changes and we have to jump in the morning, it's normally a tailwind here in the morning. It does switch when it warms up and turns into a headwind, but, you know, some of the guys in the earlier seed this weekend had to jump in a tailwind.
All right. And tell us a little bit about your time with Lake Gru Ski Fluid.
Yeah, Ski with Fluid. I teamed up with Kyle Lee like back when we started it. It was a great man-made lake. USA Water Ski started it. I sold my part of it, but Kyle Lee is still out there. And there's been multiple world records out there. It's a fantastic place. He still holds tournaments out there all year long, so it's a really cool place. It's great for skiing.
All right, then. Let's talk about a little bit about Marion.
Yeah.
tell us about that story about how you first met. Yeah. You know, and
well, first of all, she ignored me for a long
time. Ignore you?
Yeah, I mean, just, you know.
In that Gallic fashion.
I was a little bit older than her, and they're like, stay away from that guy. You know,
he's a rebel.
She's French. She's a beautiful French girl. I'm the, you know, country redneck boy in Florida. Like, and yeah, no, she would never talk to me for a long time. But I think.
How long?
I don't know, 6-7 months. Like, a long time. Like, longer than I wanted. But I guess eventually either I just wore her down. Or maybe she's always cute or funny. I don't know. But yeah, we finally started. We met through skiing, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
She came out and skied. We just, you know, I don't know, liked each other. And it turned into a family. And now we have three awesome kids. And I'm extremely blessed, extremely lucky. She's completely out of my league. And I thank her every day for going on our first date.
All right, then. So, people in relationships bring a certain, you know, certain je ne sais quoi into the equations. I'm sure you know that French expression. You know, what do each of you bring into your relationships that make each of you better as people?
Yeah, I mean, we're both competitors, and we do this not only just in water skiing, but in business, in our lives, and raising our kids. And we help each other. If one starts to slow down, we pick the other one up. And it's been an incredible, it'll be 11 years in 20 days.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's been an awesome 11 years. Like, she's incredible. Like, she still pushes me to ski, pushes me to train. If we're not doing water skiing, and it's always positive. The family's always positive. And I'm extremely lucky to have her.
Indeed, yeah. You are. So after you arrived back in Florida, you know, 11 years, so congratulations on that, by
yeah,
the
thanks.
Way. I mean,
yeah, that's pretty cool.
But I mean, you still continue to jump out. They still, still ride the jump skis. You probably don't hit the ramp at 6 foot anymore. Or
well, I do only on singles to work on my kick. I want to keep my kick fast and strong.
Mm-hmm.
So I still do only singles when it's a nice little headwind where I can land soft. But if I do ski or train or get ready for a tournament, I do 5.5 35.
5.5 35. Yeah. Did you see or hear of that jump from Daniel Dobringer?
Yes. So I do watch Daniel Dobringer and what he's doing, because he's still awesome. That guy is still jumping far. Yeah, so
guy spanking 190 feet off a 5 foot ramp. Are you kidding me?
Oh yeah, I know. I watch him. I do watch him. So, Daniel, if you're out there listening, I am watching you. In case we meet again, I got to train. So yeah, no, he's a great jumper.
You fancy a pop at the 035s?
Yes, I do. I'd like to. I like to compete with him. He's a great skier. Any other 35 guys, whatever. Come on, bring it on. I still like to compete. I'm up for any competition.
Well, that 035 competition is going to be up in the Lakes of Casting Stone in Canada, place that you've I think you've visited at least once or twice.
I've been up there a couple times. Yeah, I jumped well there. I'm ready.
Aside from your own site, which is your favorite venue?
Well, it depends on.
All right, then let's start. Let's go from the other direction. Your least favorite venue.
We had a couple World Cup sites that were very, very challenging. Normally saltwater places are pretty challenging. Open big lakes are really challenging.
Did you ever go to Mandura?
Yes, that's
like
I was trying not to say the name, but yes, that's very it's hard. It's hard to perform there. It's dangerous. Only aspect of trying to jump big, and when I say jump big, I mean trying to win for the day. You know, you had guys like Bojan Scheibner that was throwing big jumps out there, Ryan Dodd, Freddie. Like, to try and beat those guys at these challenging places, you got to roll up your sleeves and get dirty. Like, it's tough.
All right, then. So we've assessed the bad. Yeah. How about the good? No, I've given you enough to prep on here.
Yeah. I mean, believe it or not, Moomba is one of my favorite places to jump far. It's not only is it challenging, if you can figure out the current, the wind, the boat, you can go really big there. It's mm-hmm. really hard to go big there, but you can do it. I guess that's like playing chess versus checkers. Like it's a challenge that I like that place.
So when has Moomba been kind enough to you to where you have like a headwind but with a favorable current? Do you remember the?
Yeah, I mean, all the ones that I won. I know 93 I won. It was the first time I won there. 97, 98. I had a bunch of seconds. A few night jumps there.
Tell us about the night jumps with all the fireworks going off in the background.
It's awesome. It can be intimidating. It can be stressful. But if you can just let that go and enjoy the moment, focus on your jump for, 90 seconds?
Mm-hmm.
90 seconds of your time. Focus, go big, and the rest is fun. Like, I love that place. Like, it's hard, it's fun. You're in front of a huge crowd. It's my favorite place.
Tell us about the day you found out that you were about to be inducted into the Water Ski Hall of Fame.
I was in Canada driving a Jarrett's Red Bull overall tournament.
Oh, wow.
And just happened to be out of the boat in between sets. Jeff Clark called me. He's like, hey, how you doing? I was like, God, Jeff Clark.
Bit of a call out from the blue.
Yeah, out of the blue. He never calls me. What are you doing? Well, I'm in Canada driving a tournament. I was like, yeah, what's up? He's like, I just want to let you know that you're going to be the next skier inducted to the Hall of Fame. And I was just... speechless for like 30, 40 seconds. He's like, hello? I was like, Jeff, sorry. I never thought about it. Like, I never.
Because you probably saw that fat guy from the Pro Football Hall of Fame knocking on your hotel door, like saying, I'm pleased to tell you. Yep.
Yeah.
But did you imagine something like that? Or?
No, I didn't. I don't know. That was never on my radar of a goal, or I don't know. I was shocked. Obviously I said yes. I said thank you very much, but it was pretty cool. Like I never thought about. And then he was saying, you know, all your past, you've done this, you've done that, and I never really kind of put all my past together into a pot, thinking, because of that, I get this. It was a surprise, and I'm still surprised. I'm still kind of surprised about it.
Who wrote your speech?
I did.
You did? Okay.
Yeah, I did. I was. It was not. Wasn't really a thank you speech. Were you there?
No, I wasn't. Yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah. So I didn't tell anybody about it. I didn't tell my wife. I didn't tell anybody what I was going to do because I didn't want anybody to change my mind. Obviously, I said thank you to the industry, family. That part was really short. But I gave everybody a snapshot of a weekend of what the 1990s were in pro water skiing.
Wow.
So I started on a Friday morning when we left Orlando Airport, all the way back to Sunday night when we got back to the Orlando Airport, of what happened. Of course, everything that I said didn't happen that weekend, but over the course of, you know, 10 years on tour, some of those things happened, and I just incorporated it into one weekend.
Now that you've been inducted into the Hall of Fame, what advice would you give someone who's relatively new to the sport? I mean, such as the folks that are competing here, yeah, in the World Championships for the first time.
I mean, don't look at the end of the road. Like, if you're gonna, I would say men's jump tomorrow. All right, Series 2 and Series 1 have not jumped yet. I would say to Series 2 and Series 1, find out what the cut is, look at the conditions, predict what you need to jump, and then address each movement on each jump. Break it down to the cut to the 6, the turn at the 6, you know, the approach to the wake, after the wake, the glide, the turn, break it all down, and you will have a successful Worlds. Don't look at the end of the road. Don't look at the win. Don't look at the podium. Don't look at all that stuff. Because any of those guys in seed 3, 2, or 1, if they do everything perfectly on their cuts every moment, they'll podium. Any one of those guys.
Sounds like you've been coaching Brandon Shipper.
He had a great weekend. He had a great 3 jumps. I mean, he was on it. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. Like, if you look at his jumps, he didn't move, he didn't hesitate, everything was fluid, and just, he exploded off the end of the ramp. Like, I mean, that's jumping right there.
All right, then, let's shift gears a little bit. I mean, we'll try and wrap this up in a little bit. I mean, this has been an intriguing conversation, trips down memory road and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But let's bring us back to the present, where you are currently one of the 3 drivers here at the world championships.
Yeah,
and
cool.
And I mean, you're probably, I don't know if you've discussed this with the other drivers. You could actually see them from
yeah, I
here.
See Andrew over there.
You see
Glenn, Manuel. Yeah, I see them all.
You see them all. But yeah. Do you go into a kind of discussion with these drivers and say, okay, I'd much rather do this or drive that or what have you, or is it random?
These 4 guys, no, because these 4 guys, no matter what event we're in, I think we're all really good. I mean, they've all driven big jumps. They've all driven guys and girls deep in the line and slalom, and they've all driven 11,000 point trick runs. So these 4 guys, they're awesome. We get together, we talk about the boats, we talk about if there's a gust over there, and we share information, which I don't know if drivers in the past have ever done that, where they help each other. I feel like drivers in the past, they kind of like, well, I want to keep this secret, and I want to do better than him, and I want this event for over that. And
a bit adversarial, it seems.
Yeah. And these guys, I haven't felt that at all. We talk constantly about the boat, about this. We're, you know, down there, hey, you need sunscreen. Hey, you need some water. No, I'm good. Thanks, but okay. And then it's been great. I'm telling you, for a World Championships, I'm more relaxed driving than I've had in any tournament because of those guys.
Okay.
Yeah, it's cool.
So kind of what are the things that kind of like a checklist of what you would do? Like, say if you're a driving jump, which I would probably imagine you'll be doing quite a bit of between now and the end. Do you go kind of like a mental checklist of the things you need to kind of...
Yeah. I mean, I approach it like I'm doing a tournament. I calm myself down. I look at the wind. I look at the conditions. I make sure the boat's running good. I check the fuel. I took the jump switch. And I check, you know, all my equipment, you know, whether I'm skiing, is my handle, sling, and skis, or if I'm driving a boat, steering wheel, seat, you know, make sure the seat's good, make sure the mirror's good. I check all my equipment. That way I know that's good. I look at the running order. I kind of know what I've got to do. And then I set on my path, and I focus just like I do in jump. Every foot of that lake on every skier's jump. That's mm-hmm. what I do. I don't look at the event. I hope I drive good on all these guys. I want to make sure I drive good on every single foot of every single jumper on every single jump. And I would hope every jumper has a PB. I mean, if every jumper had a PB, that would be, I would retire.
I mean, but please don't be, please don't. There's yeah. a reason why they got the PB, and yeah. it was probably a good part because yeah. you were at the helm.
So yeah, I approach it just like I'm jumping in the world championship. Whether I'm jumping or driving, I approach it exactly the same. I want to do good. I want everyone to do good.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important. It's very important to me, and obviously it's important to all those jumpers and countries and captains and coaches, everybody.
Okay, we'll start to wrap this up now. Yep. But I mean, there is one. There's one. A couple of questions. Well, actually, one question and one requester from you at the end of this of this interview. Where do you see yourself in 5 years with this sport?
Yeah, I hope I'm still in the driver's seat. I hope my son is doing very well coming up in the sport, and I hope to see some big venues. I hope to see us in, you know, a bigger light, more eyeballs on our sport, because I think these athletes are not only in incredible tip-top shape, but they are incredible athletes. I mean, what they're doing on the water is phenomenal, and I hope all these guys can keep doing it.
All right, and here's the request. Take this time between now and the end of the interview to yep. to acknowledge, you know, not quite Hall of Fame, you know, like speech type style, but your opportunity to thank everyone, well, or almost everyone that has contributed to where you are today starts now.
Yeah. Can we tell you?
Yeah.
Well, I think to get to the level I have, whether it be skiing on the behind the boat or being in the boat, I've been touched by the entire industry. All the ski brands has helped me. All the rope brands, you know, all the boat brands. I've been with everybody. And I think one of the unique things about water skiing is that we're a tight-knit family skiing. I mean, we're doing this interview behind all the different countries having dinner together, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
No arguments. No nothing. Everyone wants everyone to do better because they know if they do better, we're going to do better. Mm-hmm. Like we all feed off each other. And, I mean, that's what I'm thankful for, to be part of that family, to be around the world, and to introduce my kids to the same thing.
Indeed, indeed. And we'll wrap it there. Thank you very much, Scott,
the
Rocket Man Ellis, for being a part of this episode of the TWBC yeah. podcast.
And can I say your line?
You want to see
that? I want to say it because I love it. I love the t-shirts. I have the canned coolie at home. My son Brett loves it. We love it.
Okay, for this time and this time only, Scott Ellis is going to say to you,
ciao for now.
Thank you for listening to the TWBC podcast. Be sure to check out our website at waterskibroadcasting.com. Links to our presence on major social media platforms can be found there, as well as updates to our webcast and this podcast. Duplication or rebroadcasting of this broadcast without written consent of TWBC is prohibited. Subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform and be sure to join us next time for the next edition of the TWBC podcast.